Can we compare this year's Florida's recount to the 2000 election? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. What happened 18 years ago is not the same. That was a presidential election. But history's repeating itself as Palm Beach County is back in the spotlight for all the wrong reasons. We're going to look at lessons learned from 2000 and what we might learn from this year. Also, one of the authors speaking at this year's Miami Book Fair is former WLRN reporter Rowan Morgarity. He's the author of the book, Go Tell the Crocodiles, Chasing Prosperity in Mozambique. And he'll share with us about his connection with the African nation. Finally, the Broadway hit Hedwig and the Angry Inch is playing in South Florida. We're going to meet the local actor who donned the high heels and wig. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. The 2000 recount and the ensuing court battles over who won Florida, George Bush, between Al Gore and George Bush, I should say, put Florida on the map as an essential swing state. Now, in all fairness, Florida is not the only state still trying to sort out the 2018 midterm election, but our Senate, gubernatorial, and our race for agriculture commissioner have gained national attention. We reported counting machines in Palm Beach County were overheating yesterday, and that forced them to recount tens of thousands of ballots. Yesterday, we heard the Broward election supervisor, Brenda Snipes, is hinting at leaving her post once this is all done. The deadline for the recount to finish is tomorrow, though Palm Beach County did get an extension. So, how does this election recount compare to 2000? What changes are necessary, if any? And will we be ready for 2020? Well, joining us now is retired University of South Florida political science professor Susan McManus, joining us from WUSF. Ms. McManus, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Is it fair to compare this year's election recounts in any way to what happened in Florida in 2000?
Just the chaos, I believe, and the focal point of the nation being right here in our state. And, of course, we've seen a reincarnation of all of the Florida and all the cartoons that go along with this. I saw another account. I went back and looked at some of the 2000 election commentary. People were referring to voters in Florida as buffoons. We're not hearing that now, but there was all kinds of controversy, just like there is now. But I think the problems were much more intense than now. It, at stake was a presidential election, and Florida was key. Just 537 votes were the difference between George Bush and Al Gore, as was finally ruled. We didn't have any recount rules like we do now. We had those horrible punch card voting machines with every county and every canvassing board interpreting what was a legal Chad or not Chad kind of ballot. We had rampant criticism of the quality of poll workers. We've not heard any of that this time out. So, and then also there was people saying that they just didn't understand their rights. Now we have a lot of clearing up of the protection of the poll. You're informed at the poll about your rights as a voter. Military ballots coming in and whatever were, there was no standardization. We have seen a lot of improvements since 2000. But one of the improvements that was made has now become sort of a focal point, and that is the signatures on an absentee or vote-by-mail ballot, the verification of them.
There's a lot. I want to try to tackle a couple of these things. But first, I wanted to ask about this. We look at what's going on since. The recount is supposed to finish by tomorrow. Palm Beach County looking at an extension as they're trying to do, well, they're dealing with old machines right now. But we've heard a lot from the candidates in the Senate race, Governor Rick Scott and Senator Bill Nelson, not much from the gubernatorial candidates. Why do you think that is?
The margin of, at this point, the edge that DeSantis holds, I think it's in the 30,000s, would be very, very difficult to make up. And most analysts and election officials think it's not likely. The closer one is, of course, the U.S. Senate. And one of the reasons that the focal point is on Broward is the huge number of undervotes in the Senate race compared to voters who cast, you know, a vote in the governor's race. So the question is, why? And that is at the heart of this battle.
And why do you think, I mean, what is there to gain at this point, you know, being so blusterous? They act like they're still campaigning. What's the point now? You just wait for the count to finish, the recount to finish.
It's like shouting your argument till the very end and keeping your supporters engaged, keeping your legal team, keeping avenues open legally, depending on what the outcome shows. And it's human nature of like the closer you are to victory, the more you're gonna shout one way or the other. I liken it to football, of where, you know, it was so close till the very end, and then, you know, if your team falls short, you scream that there was some kinds of bad calls by the referees or whatever else, and the winner says, well, we were a better team. That's a simplistic analogy, but you know, each side feels that they're right in this argument. And, of course, they're going to keep proclaiming that they're right.
Now, of course, both sides have also filed lawsuits. Governor Scott filing suit against the Broward County. Judge did allow for extra security. Broward Sheriff's now in the building as the recount continues. Also going after Palm Beach County, Senator Nelson. Now suing for the votes up in the panhandle. There were a couple of hundred that were faxed in or emailed in, and he wants to see those. I mean, really, at this point, though, does any of this have an impact on the process? You know, I mean, I understand what you're saying, that you want to be vocal, but does it change anything?
The only thing that's going to change it is to see how the manual recount turns out. That's critical. That's just one step down the way. The first step is the automatic recount of these three races, and if then at the end of the recount, if there's just 0.25% difference, then we go to a manual recount of ballots that were showing undervotes and overvotes. And that then is going to be a good indication of what the pool of contested ballots look like. Is it enough to overturn a race if all of them went in one direction? So we're still a couple steps away from closure on this, at least even figuring out what the pool of contested ballots is going to look like.
Yeah, and I'm going to be clear, is that Governor Scott filed a complaint with Broward, a Broward court requesting that the county canvassing board halt the inclusion of ballots in the final tally if they were counted after the Saturday deadline. Now, Senator Nelson is saying that the law requires requiring a signature on mail-in ballots to match the one on record, that he's now saying that's unconstitutional. Who has a case here?
I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not going to try to answer that one.
It's the one everybody, I know. I have to throw it out there because it's the one everybody's asking now. If that could do anything, if that's going to mean anything.
Well, I think a lot of it is going to do with really looking at the procedures that were, you know, better spelled out over the years since the 2000 election as to timetables and how you judge ballots in terms of marks and stuff. That'll happen when we get to the provisional ballot examinations and so forth. I think the only thing that I see, again, not a lawyer, that is probably not going to be easy to overturn is the extension of the time for Palm Beach to count because of equipment failure.
Right. And again, they were given an extension. They had their machines overheating yesterday. They had to recount tens of thousands of ballots. Let's go to that signature, though. Again, this is what Senator Nelson is challenging. You mentioned it earlier. Is this a unique situation you see in other states? Is this unique to Florida? The signature, when you mail in, must match what's on record.
Well, it was intended to reduce fraud. And, of course, you can't have fraudulent people registering. But the issue is that technology is way ahead of where we are with how we look at signatures. It's very difficult and subjective for people to look at a signature, you know, visually and how close do you have to be? I mean, it's not been specifically articulated as to what a perfect match looks like. Is it an initial that's missing, or what is it? I think we're going to see the legislature take up the signature issue in the next session. And the good news, and I will say, on the heels of the 2000 election, Florida made the biggest, most important changes, reforms to its election system, and it did it fairly quickly and in a bipartisan manner. I see the same thing going to happen in the next session of the Florida legislature. You're going to have voter advocacy groups. You're going to have the supervisors of elections association and some of them individually offering up new ideas as to how to better look at this signature issue. But it is true that a lot of subjectivity is in that. But on the other hand, you also have a history in South Florida of rampant abuse of absentee ballots. And one of the reasons that the signature was put in there was to try to make sure to weed out people who were fraudulently asking for someone else's absentee ballot and then signing it, and obviously the signatures didn't match the person. That said, people's signatures change with age and also with health condition. So what do we do? Do we put in something that requires every voter every year to update their signature? Or some people have suggested fingerprints. I think fingerprints is a long way off. It generates opposition on both sides of the ideological spectrum for different reasons, but a lot of which is intrusion of the government and all kinds of privacy issues.
But that's interesting.
But I think signature really has to be addressed, the whole signature issue.
But that's interesting because you said it. We're not keeping up with technology. The technology is there. So when do we finally say, okay, let's use it because it's available? I mean, and I understand the privacy issues, but at the same time, I mean, my phone turns on with my fingerprint. A lot of people, they're using fingerprint or facial recognition on their devices. So what would be the problem?
Well, that's for the elected officials to figure out. But it's also true that there's even software now that some states use, I understand, that better match signatures than just individuals looking at them. So I think we're at a bottom line. We've got to fix that. In general, I would like to say that I think part of the problem for the issues we're having right now is because we have not kept up technologically in a lot of our counties with new voting equipment. Whatever. It's very expensive. And there's always, also the case, and I'm not casting dispersions on anyone, but it's often the case that an older person, and I'm not making age-based commentary here, but someone who's more political and more in tune with interfacing with people is really less knowledgeable about IT and technology and maybe isn't as good at managing the IT part of the office as someone else and doesn't know it until things happen. I think technology and some of the mismanagement comes from that kind of disconnect.
Right. Again, we're talking to political science professor Susan McManus, and she's joining us from the studios of WUSF in Tampa. We're talking about the recount and what this could mean for the 2020 election. But, of course, we do have a post up on our Facebook, WLRN Sundial, asking you if you could change anything with the system. Let us know. A conversation's already going on right there, right now, so let us know what you think. Mr. McManus, coming back to the 2000 election, because you had mentioned this, that there were lessons learned, things changed. Do you think after this one, and you kind of touched on it, but that we're going to have to make big changes, and do you think they can happen before 2020?
Yes, I do, and I think you'll even see some money coming out of Washington, because it isn't a problem that's limited to Florida. The equipment across the country, a lot of places, has not caught up with technology. And people want instantaneous results, as you know, and the slowness of some of the machinery and stuff when there's particularly a deadline. I wouldn't be at all surprised to see if one of the changes that takes place in Florida is, and this won't make people happy who want things in a hurry, but to give a longer time period between the time period to recount, for example. As our population continues to grow, that's one of the great things. Florida is a magnet to many people. It's a great place to live, but at the same time, it does put a strain when we can't upgrade the amount of machines that are needed per voter or something. In other words, I do think that that whole arena of equipment and how much is needed and how often you have to update it and where the money comes from, because right now most of the election administration costs are borne by your local counties, and some counties are a lot wealthier than others. So that is an issue that then means it's more likely you're going to have at least some share of the funding for equipment coming from the state and or the federal government.
And you go back to 2000, that election was so close. This one, you had three major races that triggered an automatic recount. I mean, Florida hasn't changed much, and it's a very divided state, but it's a very tight place. It's a very difficult place to win because the races are always just going to be very tight.
Exactly, for a lot of different reasons. But the distance between registered Democrats and Republicans is continuing to narrow. And the fastest upswing, of course, is in the no party affiliation voters, who are primarily younger voters. I think among the youngest generation, something like 58% are registering as, or 58% of NPAs are from the younger part of our electorate. So things are changing from a partisan perspective as well, but it's highly competitive here, very, and that hasn't changed a bit. But I do at least ask your listeners to recall that the 11,000 or 30,000 or whatever vote difference doesn't even come close to the 537 that ended up electing a president.
The 2000 election went to the courts, and some of this could go to courts. It's part of our process, but is there a danger when we're asking judges to make this decision?
This is one of the biggest battles that's going on right now. It's the biggest discussion points about our whole separation of powers and balance of powers and so forth. Are the courts becoming too powerful in the election process? That's a big question. And historically, America goes through different periods of where people criticize the courts from being too strong. Other times it's the president too strong. Other times it's Congress too strong. In the election arena, I think we are headed towards a lot of discussion about the role of the courts in determining the will of the people when it comes to voting.
Again, regardless of the outcomes, what do you think that after all this is said and done? I mean, is our process, it does need some fixes, some changes, but really overall, aren't we doing a good job? Isn't the state of Florida doing
a much better job? We're doing a much better job. Look at the turnout rate went up from 51% in the last midterm election to a whopping 63% in this year's election. Why is that? It's easier to vote. It's easier to register. You have a longer time period to vote, different ways, vote by mail, in person, early in person or on election day. You can register online. You didn't used to be able to do that. And, of course, our election supervisors, people need to know, are much, much better at informing the public, whether it's through YouTubes or emails or videos or demonstrations. And, of course, we have a law that says that supervisors must go to the high schools and colleges and register and so forth. So many more ways to participate in the election system than we used to have. And I think one of the biggest improvements, and we're seeing it in this election cycle, is we have the paper trail. Think about if you had this controversy in a state where you couldn't do a manual recount that was meaningful because you wouldn't have the actual document. You couldn't check to see whether there was something wrong with the way that a machine was calibrated, but you could clearly see that somebody had marked something. What a great improvement. All of these speak to the fact that our election system overall is much more inclusive. Even if you look at the diversity in terms of age and race and ethnicity of people that are registering, Florida, again, is sort of a melting pot of the country. And our election system, even though we're right now having some controversies, Florida will be ahead of the game because others will be behind us, and we will once again probably fix some of these things and in turn cause other states to have to change their laws.
And you know, I was thinking, too, about recently in one of those lawsuits by Governor Scott, a judge actually asked all sides, please keep down the rhetoric. Please let's stop throwing, you know, certain comments towards other sides. I mean, a lot of some people say calling fraud, that fraud's being committed. And a judge is actually asking all sides, just wait till the process is done. Let's all calm down. Is there any fear about the politicization of the election process? Are we hurting people's, are we doing anything that could be hurting people's trust and faith in the system?
Absolutely. We saw that even heading into the election. There was a little bit, of course, it was due to hacking, you know, because of the presidential election. More of a fear was that our system had been a little bit, was going to be challenged by intrusion via hacking. And little did we know it would take a different turn than that. But polls were already showing nationally a fear that our system didn't have the integrity that it needed to in terms of security and sanctity of the vote. But you can look at this as sort of a glass half full or half empty. On the one hand, you could say, you know, look at all these people who voted. Look at how competitive it is and how close my candidate came to winning. And in a way, you could say that enhances somebody's likelihood of voting when they know that their vote can literally make a difference. On the other hand, you can make the argument, no, it's just half full, half empty, because a lot of people will just give up and say, well, my vote doesn't count. This is one of the age-old debates when you have problems is, what is it going to do to a person's likelihood of voting?
Yeah. Well, the recount is still going. We're going to be tracking that, and we'll have all the information for everybody as soon as all of those numbers come out and everything comes out, and we'll stay on the story. Political science professor Susan McManus joining us from the studios of WUSF in Tampa. Ms. McManus, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was great. Thank you.
And again, you can find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial. We got a conversation going there. If there's anything you'd change, we'd like to hear your thoughts. Don't forget, by the way, we have a book club. Just want to tell you about that. If you're not a member, you can find us on Facebook, Sundial Book Club. Just ask to join. Our November title is Southernmost by Silas House. Well, still to come, a former WLRN reporter shares his stories from his journeys deep in Africa. He's going to be at the Miami Book Fair. That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. So take yourself out of South Florida's urban jungle for a moment and imagine a much more remote landscape of dry, thorny forests on the banks of the Zimbazi River, deep in the jungles of Mozambique. Here in the remote community of Bawa, a town of about 1,000, people's greatest concerns are securing clean water and staying safe from one of the most dangerous predators, the crocodile. Now, this scene is one of the settings in Rowan Moore Garrity's book, Go Tell the Crocodiles, Chasing Prosperity in Mozambique. You may recognize Rowan's voice. He was the education reporter here at WLRN. Rowan's going to be presenting his book at the Miami Book Fair this Sunday. Before Rowan's reporting in Miami, he was a Fulbright Fellow in Mozambique. In a year living in the country, he discovered the complex challenges facing residents in the countryside, the politics of a fragile democracy and law enforcement, and the questionable solutions those in leadership provided to residents in need. The book is a collection of all these stories of all these people that you got to meet over that period of time that you were there. You also made a third trip in 2016. Let's pick one of the stories because I found this interesting. This leads to the title of your book, which is Go Tell the Crocodiles. Tell me about Maya Rosa.
So Maya Rosa, which means Mother Rose, she's a woman who lives really in the westernmost community in Mozambique. So Mozambique, if everybody can kind of picture where Madagascar is, that's that little island off the coast of Africa, or big island off the coast of Africa. Mozambique is between South Africa and Tanzania. And Maya Rosa lives way inland in a very remote community called Bawa. And the reason I started talking to her is because I'd heard that she was someone who had been accused by her neighbors of having used a pet crocodile or a crocodile charm to go after and kill her niece. And so the reason I was interested in visiting the place she lived is that it's a place that is a community of about 800 or 900 people, maybe as many as 1,000 people when I was there in 2011. that has lost 50 people to crocodile attacks in the 10 years before I was there. So if you imagine, I mean, that's like 5% of the population. So it's a dramatic impact, and it seemed that the explanation among people there was somebody's responsible. And Mairosa, as a widow, an older single woman, was one of the first people that sort of was blamed for this. And so there were two instances, the first in 2005 and then later in 2010 when she was accused of sending a crocodile to kill her niece.
And there's something interesting about this because it really points to, I don't know if it's the judicial system within the rural parts of the country or the whole country, but as you said, the people of the village wanted to blamed her for it. And so now they have to bring in, I guess, what is law enforcement and the judicial system into it. And it was just so odd the way they punished her, the way they tried her and punished her for this.
Let me just try to tell the story and give a little bit of context. So in 2010, Mairosa loses a niece to the river, right?
Basically, a crocodile attack.
Yeah. You never know for sure, because one of the amazing things is, you know, people are down by the water washing dishes, getting water, washing clothes. They don't have access to wells or running water in Bawa, and so the river is where you go, and the river is a very, very dense habitat for Nile crocodiles, which can get, you know, up to 15, 16, 17 feet and weigh hundreds and hundreds of pounds. So these really dangerous animals that you have to sort of interact with in some level, you know, on a daily basis. And so one day, Amelia, her niece, disappears from the side of the river. And as people sort of start to look for an explanation, they believe, yes, it was a crocodile attack, but that there may have been some sort of supernatural explanation, right? That maybe there was some jealousy between Amelia and her aunt, because Amelia had a boyfriend who went down to the big town at the other end of the river and was able to give her things and sort of lavish all this attention upon her. And Mairosa was there kind of scratching out a living from her dry little fields. And so people kind of round her up and they go and look to a neighboring community to get a spiritual healer or a curandero, someone who uses sort of traditional remedies and kind of channels spirits in a way to ascertain her guilt. And they find hints that, look, actually, Mairosa is the person who did it. And she was on the point of being thrown in a sack and thrown into the river and kind of sacrificed herself to the river in this kind of form of vigilante justice when someone called the cops from the county seat across the river. And the cops come over and they are able to sort of calm everybody's nerves, and they eventually send the case to community court. And community court, it is in the sort of most remote parts of Mozambique, it is the dominant manifestation of the justice system. In the cities, Mozambique will have ordinary courts like we'd have here. But because it's a country where there are huge chunks of the territory where the government doesn't have a very robust day-to-day presence, people have to resolve their disputes in the way they always have, right? So, you know, community leadership, traditional leadership's really important. And sometimes that can take a really ugly form. And so the community court sort of came to be as a way to mediate between the sort of cruelties or the potential for cruelty or unfairness in traditional, you know, justice and the sort of desire to you know, create a new court system or a more sort of formal government-led court system when you don't really have the resources to do it. And so what they do is they say, okay, go clean the police station for a few days and then, you know, promise never to use your crocodile again and we can all forget this. And a year later, I go back into the village and it's just astounding because seemingly Mairosa is living once again sort of integrated with the people she's grown up with on the one hand, but also the people who tried to kill her, you know, less than 2 years earlier.
The other aspect of that story I thought was interesting is how the government handles the crocodile issue, the human animal conflict, but especially crocodiles, and what it speaks to really how the government deals with people who live way out here, you know, like Rosa, way out there, away from the central areas. They basically go and hunt these creatures down. and try to use that as a way of telling people we're here to take care of you.
Basically, the government comes out once a year and they have a quota for how many crocodiles they're told to kill on that river every year. The problem is, if you kill 200 crocodiles, well, it's still going to be an attractive place for 200 more crocodiles that can come down from rivers in Zambia, rivers in Zimbabwe, that feed into the Zambezi. And the other problem is, you know, if you only do that hunt once a year, well, let's say you do that hunt in November, but the last disappearance was in August. How do you know you're getting the right crocodile? And just like in accounts of tigers and bears and other things, the way we deal with sort of problem animals in other parts of the world, there's some evidence that once a crocodile, you know, eats or attacks one person, that's a good candidate for the crocodile that would be involved in the next attack. So you don't know you're getting the right crocodiles, and you might just sort of make things worse by inviting other crocodiles down the river. And there's a very good biological explanation for why this part of the river is so dangerous. And basically, it's what one crocodile biologist I spoke to called crocodile heaven, partly because of the way it's always been, just this sort of big, vibrant, very game-rich, you know, river ecosystem, and partly because the Portuguese built a huge dam there in 1975, or that was completed in 1975, just around independence, and that has really drastically altered the ecology. This is a guy I talked to called Richard Ferguson, who's a white Zimbabwean man who's studied crocodiles along the Zambezi his whole life.
In the long term, crocodiles benefit from dam building. Because you take, you know, you take a riverine, a linear riverine system. Crocodiles are very shoreline-oriented animals. You know, and you put a dam across something like that, all you're doing is creating a pile of shallow water habitat.
You took a small amount of habitat that was already very favorable to crocodiles, and you made it a much larger amount of habitat. And in addition to that, you have all these fish parts and plant parts and algae and microbes and stuff that's coming sort of in the flow of the river down towards the ocean as it naturally would, except now with this wall here, it stops, and all that sediment drops out in this one place where these two rivers come together, where one of the tributaries flows into the Zambezi right around Bawa, where Rosa lives. And you know, it's a very rich fishery. All the animals up and down the food chain can feed on that.
And, you know, it comes back to what the government tries to do for the people, or what it's, you know, maybe the better way to put it is just, you know, doing as little as possible, but kind of trying to create this idea that, well, we're here to help you when they do these hunts, which again is not doing really much of anything.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a difficult thing. And, you know, to be fair, it's just a huge undertaking to imagine trying to bring infrastructure and build institutions across a territory the size of Mozambique in such a short interval, right? And you have all these people are coming back into the country after the war and settling there. So I don't want to understate how difficult it is. But the fact is, on a day-to-day basis, the government can't provide electricity. It can barely pay teachers. It can barely field a police force. It can't provide running water. And so in, you know, most days of the year, people are pretty cut off from any kind of support. They're kind of asked to fend for themselves. But, you know, once a year, they come out and you show that the government is sort of taking care of these deadly foe, the crocodiles that menace your whole community, that have killed 5% of the people where you live in the last 10 years. And they drag them out of the water and show the carcasses on shore for everybody. And so it's a way for the government to say, look, we're doing something. And what's funny about it is when you talk to the people who are involved in the cull, they'll tell you, just as the crocodile biologist was, look, there's a natural phenomenon here that you're not going to be able to get around until you build some running water. They'll say, I don't think this is very effective. But, you know, as one of the guys said to me, you know, it's a political solution. It's not a technical solution. And what he meant by that is, if you go into one of these villages along the Zambezi in an election year, he said, and you try to ask for people's votes, and you haven't hunted crocodiles, or you haven't come out there and done the sort of mitigation of these animal, you know, human-wildlife conflicts, if you haven't come out and done a crocodile call, you know, people will say to you, go tell the crocodiles to vote for you.
The book is Go Tell the Crocodiles, Chasing Prosperity in Mozambique by former WLRN education reporter Rowan Moore-Garrity. Rowan, thanks so much, man.
Thanks, Lewis. Great to talk with you.
And you can find more details about Rowan's event at the Miami Book Fair this Sunday by going to our website, WLRN.org. Well, coming up, we are going to hear from Colombian rock star Juanes. He's got a nomination in this year's Latin Grammys in Las Vegas coming up tomorrow. But first, a genre-bending rock musical in Broward features a Miami native as its star. That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The song Sugar Daddy is the anthem for the cult classic genre-bending rock musical Hedwig and the Angry Inch. The show, written, directed, and performed by John Cameron Mitchell, first premiered off-Broadway 20 years ago, stunning audiences with its progressive look at homosexuality and transgender rights. It follows Hedwig, an East German immigrant who got a sex change and moved to the United States, started a rock music career, and had his lyrics stolen by his former lover, Tommy Gnosis. Hedwig and the Angry Inch is currently being performed at the Broward Center for the Performing Arts until November 25th. Miami native and New World School of the Arts graduate Dominic Scott plays Hedwig, and he joins us now. Dominic, it's such a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the air.
So you know what, folks who have seen the show on Broadway or have seen the film, it's unlike any traditional performance, but take me into the room at the Broward Center as an audience member. Describe to me what the experience is going to be like for me.
Well, different is probably the best way of describing it. I mean, it's we're very fortunate that our show is in a small, intimate space. So, you know, the show is very much a rock concert. It's got a lot of elements of like stand-up comedy, but then it's also a musical, and there's a really heartfelt and endearing story at the heart of it. So, you know, as we're telling the story and I'm prancing around in high heels and all these wigs and makeup, the audience is very much, very much involved and in the center of it. In fact, you know, every show is completely different. You know, one show I brought somebody up on stage that wasn't planned. Another show I'll spend more time in the audience. But overall, it's a lot of fun. Really raw.
I've heard interviews with actors who've taken on this role, and in one of them, I heard basically this is not a role that you can phone in. You have got to make the full transformation to really get into it. What was the process like for you in making that transformation? And describe a little bit about who Hedwig is.
Yeah, so it's definitely, I mean, so Hedwig doesn't leave the stage at all and is for the full 90 minutes. So it's all talking and singing for a straight 90 minutes, and which is, it took a lot of preparation. It took about 3 months of memorizing, because that's always the hardest part as an actor. You kind of have to get through the text first before you can, you know, really start letting go and making it your own. But yeah, it took, you know, 3 months of memorizing, of really figuring out every part of the story, which, you know, in my opinion, it's a beautiful story. It's about this person's journey. He started out, he was born in Germany, this young gay boy named Hansel. And he grew up in war-torn Germany, you know, in East Berlin when the Berlin Wall was up. Very, you know, socially and economically depressed, you know, his society was. And so he wanted to get out at all costs. You know, he had almost nothing. It didn't have a lot of life experience. And the one way he was able to get out was he fell in love with a man, and the man said, you know, an American soldier, and the American soldier said, well, I will take you to the United States where there's opportunity and we can be together and, you know, live our lives together, but you're going to have this sex change operation. So he decided, you know, he said to his mom, should I do this? Is that, and he did it under the pretense of maybe this might be my only way out of this current situation, you know, the depression of East Berlin. So he did it, but which is why it's interesting to note a lot of people mistakenly think of Hedwig as transgender, but that's not really an accurate description of Hedwig, because most transgender people they're born with one gender and then they decide, you know what, this isn't who I am. Whereas in Hedwig, he didn't really make the choice because he wanted to be a woman. He made it out of a necessity, or so he thought, a necessity to get out of Berlin. And more so, the operation ended up being botched, which kind of is the centerpiece of the theme of gender identity in Hedwig. There's this sense of like, well, who am I? I'm not quite a man. I'm not quite a woman. And I think overall, the text of Hedwig really wants us to see people as people. And the less we can define people by in a box of sexuality or a box of gender, and instead of trying to label each other as different things, race, or, you know, I mean, it extends to anything. But getting away from labels and trying to see people as human beings who all have different life journeys and experience, that's kind of the core message for me and Hedwig. And so Hedwig goes to the States and then meets some – the whole point of the show is he's looking for his other half. And when he gets to the United States, you know, he's still searching for his other half. And it's and I don't want to give too much away, but
that's okay.
It's good. Yeah.
You know what? It's something you said that was interesting is the fact that you're on stage pretty much the entire show.
Yes.
So that in of itself is, and anybody who's ever done theater knows that's a marathon. But something that was interesting too is, I mean, I want to know how you prepare for that physically. But the night that my producer went to the show, one of your high heels broke, and you just you had to keep performing with one broken shoe.
Yeah, I got my heel broke during the opening number. In fact, so I spent for the next 70 minutes performing. I somehow, to be honest, I don't know how I did it, but I guess I kept my weight on the balls of my feet for the entire show, and I was able to kind of get through it. And then it broke. Hedwig has like a meltdown at the end, and you know, and takes off his heels. So it kind of broke. Then it really broke, like it shattered right at that moment. So it kind of worked out for that show. But yeah, I was lucky. I'm not quite sure how I did that actually.
Let me finish up with this. I'm curious, when you think about the audience. The range of people, that you know, ages, the different ages, from young people to elderly. I mean, considering the crass nature of some of the language and the progressive issues involved, does it surprise you when you see such a wide demographic of people?
No. I think it's, you know, it's 2018, and I think we're becoming a lot smaller of a world. We're becoming a lot more connected, and I think it's great. I think, first of all, it's a rock show, you know, so it's that appeals to a very large variety of people. It's fun, it's engaging, it's, you know, there's a sense of anything can happen. So it's got elements for everybody, no matter what your background is. But in terms of, yeah, for the social themes, it's great. The more people there, the more different types of people, the more we become more inclusive as a society and kind of learn from each other, you know.
Dominic Scott again is the lead in the show Hedwig and the Angry Inch. If you know nothing about the show, please at least Google it and check it out. But check out the show, because as Dominic said, every night it's a little different. You just don't know what to expect. Dominic, man, it's been an absolute pleasure. I really appreciate it. And break
Likewise.
A leg.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
Again, Hedwig and the Angry Inch will be at the Broward Center for the Performing Arts through November 25th. You can find photos and videos on our Facebook and Twitter, WLRN Sundial. And finally today... The Latin Grammys are tomorrow night in Las Vegas. Back in April, we interviewed Colombian rock star musician Juanes before his Miami performance at the American Airlines Arena. Juanes has been nominated for the award of short form music video for his song Padentro in the 2018 Latin Grammys. We talked about his music and how it has evolved over his musical career. And he started off by telling us what he loves about the city of Miami.
Well, for me, Miami is almost like my hometown, you know, it's my second home. I'm living here for almost 13 years, and I really love the community here. And it's like being in some part of South America, Latin America, in the United States.
You're originally from Colombia, and I wondered, what were your early musical inspirations as a child?
Well, when I was a kid, I was very influenced by folk music from all Latin America. I would say tango music, for example, artists like Carlos Gardel or Lucho Gatica from Chile, or Los Panchos, Los Médicos. That was like my first approach to music. Then when I get like 13, 14 years old, I get crazy with rock music and I start to listen to all rock bands at that time, like Metallica, Slayer, Sepultura, Pink Floyd, all those bands. I think I'm just learning and putting a little bit of everything into my music.
Talk about Metallica and Black Sabbath. And, you know, I wondered how you incorporated that metal theme into your rock music and even into your folk music.
At the beginning, I was actually playing metal music. So I was part of a rock band called Ecchymosis back in 1988. And we were trying to sound like Metallica. We were trying to play like them. And that was like our obsession. But I think through the past of the years, probably we realized that we wanted to have our own sound. So I guess the influence of that music is still in me, you know, even if I don't play that, my music doesn't sound like them. But I feel so inspired, you know, by these guys and the idea of being a rock star traveling around the world and playing guitar.
Your album from last year, Mis Planes Son a Marte, won the Latin Grammy for Best Pop Rock Album. And a number of those tracks speak to the musical styles that you grew up with in Colombia. Talk about the track Fuego.
Fuego is a song that has a lot of influence from Guasca music, which is one of my favorite rhythms, originally from my hometown, Medellin. Yo que he esperado tanto, apágame este fuego, fuego. Con tus labios me quemo, quemo. Hasta las sábanas las prendemos. Mira lo bien que nos entendemos cuando lo hacemos. Quiero. I grew up listening to all this music because of my parents and my brothers. So Fuego, for example, and La Camisa Negra and some other songs of my catalog has this specific rhythm, which is like a mix of vallenato with reggae, with funk.
You've made it a point to make a lot of your music socially conscious, in particular highlighting the environmental and economic plight of many Colombians. Your nonprofit organization, Mi Sangre, has worked with thousands of children in impoverished regions. What are the issues right now in Colombia that you want to make sure people know about?
Well, the most important thing right now is that we are passing through a very difficult situation because we are just about to turn the page and start a new structure, a new country where peace is possible for our young generations. And through Fundación Mi Sangre, we have been working with all leaders in communities, trying to empower them for them to be like leaders and just bring the concept of peace to our imaginarium. That's what we are doing now more than ever and trying to use music.
The year before that, you played the peace concert at the border of Colombia and Venezuela. Talk about this ongoing refugee crisis there and the potential to mend the ties between the two countries.
Well, I think now the problem is going out of control. In Colombia, we are receiving Venezuelan people with open arms because I think 15, 20 years ago, it was the opposite. You know, Colombian people were going to Venezuela. And so I think we all know that and we understand what is happening in Venezuela and we support them 100%.
If there's a message that you want to share with your Spanish audience in Spanish, would you please do so?
Bueno, para mí es muy importante recordarle a toda la comunidad hispana que está en este país que tenemos que pensar como uno y que ahora más que nunca debemos permanecer unidos y debemos de permanecer siempre conectados a nuestras raíces con miras hacia el futuro también para consolidarnos y ser fuertes cada vez.
Juanes, it's been such a pleasure. I really appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you so much, man.
And that is Colombian rock star Juanes to our non-Spanish-speaking audience. This is what he said. Basically, it's very important to remind our Latino community in the U.S. that we have to think like one and that right now, more than anything, we have to stay united and stay true to our roots and grow strong together. Again, he's nominated for the award of short form music video for his song Padentro. The Latin Grammys are tomorrow in Las Vegas. Well, that's our program for today, this Wednesday, November 14th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Bye.